Hello, and welcome to Albertans for Sensible and Compassionate Government.
We believe that Alberta government policies are harming Alberta families and our economy. We want to talk about alternatives.
Over the next weeks and months, we'll be inviting guests to discuss ways to bring a sensible and compassionate government to Alberta.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ron Bell, and I'm the host of this podcast. You can read my blogs and listen to all of our podcasts on my website, sensiblealberta.ca. You can help continue the discussion by sharing Sensible Alberta with your friends and groups. So thanks for doing that if you do get around to it. Now let's get on with today's podcast. With us today is MLA Lila Ahir. Lila, MLA for Chestermere Rocky View, was elected in 2015. A Wildrose Party member, she's currently the Education and Status of Women critic. Mrs. Ahir has been a proud small business owner since 1998. She successfully operated a number of small businesses, including Ahir Studio of Performance, where we are right now, and Chestermere's West Creek Auto Wash. So thank you, Lila, for joining us today.
It's such a privilege, and I'm very grateful to have this opportunity.
Well, there's so much for us to get into, and our discussion earlier on was interesting, so let's get right to it. The big story in Alberta politics right now is the potential union of the Wildrose and PC parties to form the Alberta Conservative Party. Where do you stand on that, and what do you think is going on right now?
Well, if there's any indication by the sale of memberships right now, it looks to me like, well, at least with the people that I've had the opportunity to speak with, which I have to say is a lot of people, the memberships are just flying out the door. And people are so happy to see that politicians are willing to work together to try and bring this family back together, to try and figure out what we can do that's in the best interest of Albertans, because it's not about power, right? It's about excellent leadership and an excellent group of people that care about this province.
Right. Well, Lila, I currently have a Wildrose membership and I need to renew it so that I can vote. So I'm going to get that done. But people are suggesting that it's probably a good idea to get a PC membership and vote for this union as well. Is that what people are saying?
There's a lot of different options. And it's funny that you should bring that up, because I've spent probably the last 4 weeks speaking out about various ways that we can do this, and also speaking to our younger groups of people as well, too, because people may not be aware, but if you're 14 years old, you can have a PC membership and also vote. And if you're 16, you can have Wildrose membership. So we have an entire group of people, young people, that can flex their political muscle and have participate in the democratic process, which would just be beautiful for them, especially because their families are going to be involved. This is epic times in politics. So I really believe with all my heart that, you know, the most important thing, and I'm just going to throw a few dates out there. I'm sure people know this, but memberships have to be purchased by July 8th. Have to be purchased in order for you to be able to vote for the ratification of the deal on July 22nd. So those are a few important things, and I highly recommend one or both memberships in either or both parties, and get yourself out there. It's a great time to be democratic and participate.
Okay, well, for me, I'll get out and buy my memberships right away so I don't have to remember July the 8th. And the vote is on July the 22nd for both parties?
Yes, so the vote's on the 22nd for both parties. There, of course, is a different mechanism for both parties on how that vote goes forward. However, once we know on the 22nd what's going to go on, then we're going to be full-fledged into leadership race shortly after there.
Okay, so the PC party requires a 50% threshold to pass and say, yes, we want to form a coalition. And the Wildrose Party requires 75%, which is a much higher threshold. How do you think the 75% is looking? What do you feel? What do you think is going to happen with that?
Well, and again, I can only base it on the information that I have coming into me. And we've done a tremendous amount of outreach with respect to this. And I'm hoping for more than 75%. If Chestermere Rocky View is any indication as to what's going on, and this is just such a fabulous riding, and these people are engaged, Ron, like really engaged. If this is any indication, I think we're going to do even better than that. I think this is about our province, about our children and our grandchildren. People get that, and it's very important to them.
Well, we're feeling the pain of the NDP government, and if that isn't motivation enough, I guess I don't know what is, right? So in this agreement, there's a temporary agreement or a tentative agreement, mm-hmm. and it has a clause in it that talks about the use of the Wild Rose money, right. And that's been an issue for people. Mm-hmm. It says that the Wild Rose Party money, which is about $1 million, which mm-hmm. has been saved up to fight the NDP in the next election, should be used for such other purposes as are permitted by law. But mm-hmm. what does that mean? What does permitted by law mean?
Yeah, so I'm going to actually go into sort of a little bit of specifics, but based on what we've heard from the chief electoral officer, that we can use the existing party funds in the event that our parties unite. So anything that's not deemed a contribution to the other party would be allowable. So that includes, you know, sharing of data, membership lists. We can use existing money to maintain databases. We can also find ways to support staff. Funds can be used for things like voter ID, polling, research, that kind of thing. And also with under the agreement, so there's all three parties, right? We have the legacy parties of the Wild Rose and the Progressive Conservatives, and then the new party, the United Conservative Party. Once they're under the same leader, those existing funds can also be used to promote that leader.
Okay.
So hopefully that helps to clarify a little.
It does. Now, having been involved with elections before and having mm-hmm. been budget director of a party, I know that those are costs that you do incur when you're in an election. So it does go toward fighting an election, but it wouldn't include things like signage or advertising. Mm-hmm. Those things would not be permitted by law.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so just be clear.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But these costs, other costs that are incurred in winning an election, mm-hmm. they could be expanded on, that kind of stuff.
So I think we've been really clear from the beginning that those funds are going to be used in extremely meaningful ways to defeat the present government. So we want to advance the conservative cause, right?
Right. And did you mention that the money would or would not be used to pay off any PC debts?
Not to pay off PC debts at all. That is absolutely, the agreement is absolutely clear on that piece.
Okay, thank you. So all of this effort that the two parties are going into right now and the team that created this this agreement mm-hmm. so that we could go forward is really for one reason only, and that is to rid Alberta of the NDP government and these destructive policies. We've been through it for more than 2 years mm-hmm. now. What are your thoughts regarding the NDP's management of Alberta's finances, just for one thing?
Yeah, and I'm going to, if I might, just clarify one piece. Absolutely, the NDP I'm not exactly even sure, even having lived and breathed it and marinated in it, it's such a deep-rooted desire to make sure that we have good governance in this province. And I think it goes even beyond just getting rid of this government, right? It's about collaboration, and it's about bringing forward really good governance, governance that can stand the test of time, that actually cares about the province, it lacks that ego, you know, that you find that seems to happen every time a government seems to get into power, that we want to make sure that it's not just about getting rid of the NDP, but that we actually have this awesome government coming forward that cares about the people of this province. So if I could I just want to clarify that point, at least
Perfect.
From my perspective, that's very important. And your second question was with respect to the finances, the destructive policies on finances. Well, I mean, we've been very vocal. I mean, we're looking at a $10.6 billion deficit at this point, potentially close to $100 billion by the time this government is out of power, right? That speaks to the lack of understanding of the privilege you have of spending other people's money. And any time that you have that privilege, whether it is in your business or whatever that is, whatever you have going on in your life, but at this level, when we're dealing with massive amounts of money coming in from Albertans that on average are paying 43% in taxes, what a tremendous privilege, right? Mm-hmm. So we're demanding and always have transparency and accountability. And the biggest issue that, and I can only speak for myself personally at this point in time, is that the government presently, the NDP government, is choosing to act as though they're bankrolling their ideas. And I've heard them use that language. It's inappropriate. It's your money. It's my money. It's our great-grandchildren's money. It's not acceptable.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I think a lot of Albertans hear that countries and provinces, they all are incurring big deficits and debt, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a common thing. But for the people I know, it's about value. It's about what do we get for the money we spend? And at times we might be spending a little more than we actually are having income, but people don't get why we would need to spend 20% more than our neighbors in BC to get the same or less. We are good shoppers, you know, as Albertans. We shop at Costco for this and our meat market for that. And, you know, we work hard to save our money. Albertans aren't getting why we should not feel the same way about our government and that they should get good that we should be getting good value. We get outcomes for the money we spend. The outcomes in education. We want outcomes in healthcare, especially if we're going to be paying more. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's actually a really good question. If we're looking at it from the perspective kind of like what you're talking about with regards to a household, well, every household would be considered conservative then, wouldn't it? Because given the circumstances of your life, you're either going to tighten your belt or you're going to borrow money or you're going to do what you need to do to keep your family going. But ultimately, you and I are responsible to the bank and everything else to make sure that those debts are paid down. There's always going to be times where we're going to have to look at things and take a look at the overall mechanism and what's best for Albertans at that time. But you have to be able to justify those things through what you said was those outcomes. So the policy presently at this point in time is very short on that piece of the outcome. So if we look at the light bulbs, right, that's just one particular piece. If we look at Bill 1, I mean, I could go on and on about Bill 1, something that was actually supposed to save families money, which we're seeing the absolute unintended consequences and fallout from this bill. And we saw it coming. We tried to alter it. We tried to help out with that. Like I said, I could talk to you for 4 hours about that one. The unintended consequences of the carbon tax, right? You know, something that was supposed to produce one thing or another. Most Albertans didn't buy into that. They know better. They know that their tax dollars are better in their pocket where they can spend it. And the other thing that's frustrating is that when we're looking at outcomes, governments have to understand, especially in this province, we help our neighbors. We don't have to be told to do that. We are genuinely thoughtful, loving people. We want to make sure that our governance always helps out the vulnerable populations. But if your fiscal house is out of order, you can have all of the best intentions. It's not going to happen.
You can't get the money to the right people.
You can't.
When it's gone run amok like it is now.
In my opinion, I would have to say that's the biggest concern. And coming from a background where I have a special needs son, I've been very, very blessed to be able to participate in a province that took care of my child and met his needs. And I knew that that was because the policies that were there were reflective of what those children needed, because we all know if we can get those kids on the right track, they're going to, and like all children, every child is born for a reason. They all have a mechanism and a reason for being here. So our responsibility is to make sure, whether that's through education or healthcare or whatever, that those children are taken care of. But you can't do that if you are spending money where without transparency and where it's not having its most effect for the people that most need it.
Yeah, terrific. I just before we get on to education, which I really want to do because I know you have so much to offer, is there anything else about the climate change plan? You talked about the carbon tax. Is there any other comments about the climate change plan, and does it give us social license? Is it going to help Alberta, or are the costs going to increase and make us less competitive, whatever?
Well, I feel like I could write an essay on social license. One of the things I want to say is, and I'll sort of put it towards the pipeline discussion. Here's the thing, is that we have this incredible arm's length group called the NEB, the National Energy Board. National infrastructure like pipelines are prosperity for all people in Canada. The NEB is our social license. Those are the people that work with those folks along the disturbance lines. They work with folks to maintain relationships that may be impacted by, you know, putting in pipelines or anything like that, or in any of these situations, or in our province, we have our own regulatory board. The whole purpose of that is to make sure that there's legitimacy and commitment to the folks that are impacted mostly by things that happen with that kind of infrastructure. The minute that any government or anybody gets involved that is not on the side of making sure that the technical aspects of that are under control, so that when that's presented to the federal government, so Mr. Trudeau and his cabinet ultimately are responsible for those decisions. And they have to do that based on that knowledge of what would be deemed as true social license. right? Mm-hmm. But it's become a word that has, or I guess a term that has been turned around to justify versus what it was originally intended to do, which was actually to help the mechanism work appropriately. So that's my frustration over that, is that we have a term that was initially put forward in order to make sure that the industry did right by the people that were in those surrounding areas. And now it's being used as something that we're supposed to garner based on taxing our people, like out of their pocket somehow, and it doesn't do anything to the GHGs. It does nothing to impact the climate positively.
No environment was affected during this carbon tax, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the NDP government pretty much ignored the whole contributions Alberta and the wealth of Alberta and the wealth of the industries of mining and drilling for hydrocarbons has contributed to Canada over the years. It's over $200 billion been transferred. That's been money that has been spent in education, schools, and healthcare in other provinces, in equalization payments over the years. And they just ignore it.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept because I was on that panel for the equalization payments. And one of the things that was really interesting is that other provinces have the ability to be independent if they were able to bring forward their natural resources and were encouraged to develop their own natural resources. But because of banning on fracking and so many other things, these provinces don't have the natural resources to be able to support themselves. And believe me, like I had said earlier, Albertans want to help their neighbors, okay? It's not about not wanting to help our neighbors, but it's about legitimately understanding that, okay, well, that money's going over there. When does that come back to help the people of the province that helped proliferate that money in the first place? So we have to look at that formula. We have to look at if that spending is operational or if it's actually going towards services that are equalizing across the board for all families and people across this country of ours. So we brought in a wonderful expert. Brian Jean did a phenomenal job putting this panel together. I was so proud of him. I was really, really proud to be a part of that. And this government right now, the NDP government, should be pushing to look at that formula to protect the province that they are having the privilege to lead right now. But instead, it's been put off to, oh, we'll discuss it later, or it's no big deal. Well, I'm telling you, every single Albertan will resonate with the fact that this is a big deal.
It's not on their radar. They were busy negotiating carbon tax arrangements with the federal government.
Or else being downgraded to an AA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Leela, you're a wealth of information on so many topics, but I really want to get to education. And you're currently the critic for education and the status of women. So what are the most important issues that you're dealing with right now in the critic work that you're doing?
Overwhelmingly, there's a couple of things. So when Bill 1 came in, with the React to reduce school fees, and of course there was a chunk of money in there for busing fees as well too. Our major concern was that, and because as you know, Wildrose policy is to get rid of school fees altogether. Like that's been a long-standing policy of Wildrose, yeah. So our desire is also to do that. So we were happy to see that the government, originally the NDP government had promised a 50% reduction. They went with a 25%. But nevertheless, we thought, okay, they're looking at some attrition or figuring out ways to get this money into the hands of people. So I was, when the bill first came out, I was, you know, on board with trying to make sure that this bill passed. We had some concerns and I brought those to light. So here's the thing. Bill 1 did not, in my opinion, actually look at the numbers. If you look at schools and school authorities and school boards, a lot of these things were already subsidized by those school boards. So if you don't understand the numbers and the amount of money that was already being spent through the education already in order to subsidize these things for families, you wouldn't have a fulsome picture of the actual dollars that need to be spent in order to provide transportation and school fees. So I really believe with all my heart that there was no outreach, that there was absolutely no collaboration with school authorities, school boards, parents, teachers, anybody to find out whether this bill was actually going to do what the intention of this bill was to do. So what ends up happening is that and it's only for public schools, and that's fine. Most parents that are at independent school authorities are just fine with that. But what ended up happening is to families, for example, in the south at the Canyon Meadows and Robert Warner School, which is a it's an alternative school offered by CBE for families that want their children to learn Spanish. So 47 communities, right, of different children all coming together to these schools. And the elementary schools generally went to senior high school. So they worked together, they had a busing system, everything. As a result of Bill 1, these parents now, their fees have doubled. So from $350 per child to $700 or so dollars per month. And even then, those parents were like, okay, we can do this. This is worth it. This is a school of choice. Then they weren't allowed to have a yellow school bus. So 10-year-olds are to take a bus, get off, change to a bus, get off, change to transit, go to their school, walk 15 minutes to school, go to school. Now, understand this 10-year-old is starting at 6:50 in the morning and then does the exact same trip backwards, sometimes changing downtown, and comes home at 5 p.m. And his little sister or bigger brother that is in the other school, their bell times had to switch in order to facilitate the buses that were going to go there. So the kids can't even go to school at the same time. So not only did this completely backfire, but now parents who actually wanted to do that program would have to drive. I'm sorry, I'm not sure how that's more environmentally friendly when they were already all on the bus together. Now all of a sudden you have all these parents that are going to need to drive their kids to school, right? And the second piece of that is that it's impacted them so badly that most of these parents are actually pulling their kids from this amazing program. The fallout to this program, to this alternative program, is off the chart.
So if I understand it right, a student and a family would have to pay almost double more and then go through all this public transit system and transfers and everything with the increased fee.
Yes.
And it's causing such strain on the families that they're saying we can't go to that school anymore.
That is correct.
It was just thoughtlessness. It was a political decision to make a Bill 1. It had nothing to do with people saying we need a solution to this problem. They didn't work it out with people. It was just charging ahead with something they didn't understand. Is that?
Same pattern as so many of these other things. First of all, lack of consultation. Yeah. The inability to make sure that you understand the consequences of your bill. And the third piece is making sure that you are protecting the children, safe and caring spaces, that they can be educated, parental choice in education, all of the things that are the fabric of the education system in Alberta.
Oh, man. There's echoes of Bill 6
don't get me started.
One after another, mm-hmm. after another. Well, thank you for sharing it. I had no idea that families were going through this, and I'm so glad that I guess we all are, that you're working on it to help and letting them know that the situation is bad. And
it's an honor. It's truly a privilege.
So, Leela, also, the Red Deer Public School Board recently voted mm-hmm. to form a single publicly funded school system, eliminating Catholic school funding, if I got that right.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So, it's interesting. There's been a couple of attempts to try this whole mechanism, and I think what people have to realize is that the Catholic school system is entrenched in the Constitution. The Catholic system is pervasive, not only within the school system, but throughout their entire education within their family and their extracurricular activities. And this is a protected mechanism in our Constitution. And it's they were trying to use the excuse that it was going to save taxpayer money and all of these kinds of things. And to tell you the truth, those kids would have to just stop going to school altogether to actually save money. So this is about publicly funded school, which is part of the impressiveness of what we have here in this province. And I would like to say that, as always, and as Wild Rose policy, we will stand up every single day of our lives to make sure that there's choice in education for our children.
So the Wild Rose Party wouldn't support that separation and the closing of a school system, of the Catholic school system, to try to save some money.
Well, and the caveat to that is that if those two school boards, like if that Catholic school board and that public school board between themselves and their families decided to do that, well, it's not the place of government to overstep that boundary. That's an elected board, right? Those are elected by the people in that area. Maybe there's a reason for them to do that. So if between the two of them, and I mean, to tell you the truth, those school boards were already doing that. They were already sharing buses. They were already saving money. So I would have to believe that the people that we put in charge of these situations have the wherewithal and the capability to decide what's best for them and their students. I mean, these are individual units. This is local decision making at the best, right? So, no, there's two pieces to that. Is that I will always support, and as will Wild Rose, will always support choice in education. But at that school level, at that local level, well, my goodness gracious, if those two school boards decided that that was the best thing for them, well, who am I to say? Like, have at her.
All right.
But that's not what happened here.
Right. And so the process, that final process of trying to eliminate the Catholic system is not going to happen.
No.
But it sounds like maybe there's some sensible cost-saving sharing that other people might look at and say this Catholic system could share with this, and is there maybe...
Yeah, and that would be up to them.
Yeah.
Like, let them make that decision based on their families and their people and their needs, right? Like, let's give them the responsibility that we charge them with.
Yeah. So, Leela, the NDP Education Minister, David Egan, recently ordered two Baptist schools to allow gay straight groups to be formed. Where is that now, and what are your thoughts on that whole issue?
Well, there was a report that was brought forward. We haven't heard anything, and in typical government style, heaven only knows when they'll release that report. I mean, look at what just got released about the wildfires, right? So, I mean, I could go on and on about panel discussions that we haven't heard hide nor hair of from any of the discussions out so far. But this is a perfect example of divisiveness on behalf of a government. We have the opportunity here with all of these schools for a really strong government and a strong minister to be able to look into those schools and go, okay, let's explain what a GSA is. A GSA is a human rights group. It's not mandated, and it is simply that, and it's the opportunity for these kids, should they desire to do so, to meet and get together and talk about bullying or how their day was or how to create friends and alliances. I mean, it's about love and community building and learning to work with people and understanding and trust and all the things we expect all of our children to learn via faith or family or whatever those kinds of things are. So a strong minister would have looked at that opportunity and gone, oh, let's have a discussion about this. Let me help you go through this. But instead, it became this divisive situation that, in my opinion, does nothing to help the children of this province.
Sort of adversarial,
yes,
attack approach, and,
yes,
and wasn't necessary.
This isn't about building community, right? This isn't about building relationships between children. This became a politicization event of our children. It's completely contradicts the whole reason that we have, in my opinion, an education minister. Like, the education minister had a wonderful opportunity here to clarify what GSAs are.
Okay, thank you. And Leela, there is a dramatic curriculum change underway in Alberta.
Yes,
you kind of alluded to it before, and I tell you, there's a lot of talk going on that I'm even hearing about it. Could you tell us more about what you're hearing from parents and students and teachers, and mm-hmm. maybe a little bit more of what's really happening
yeah.
out there?
First of all, I want to thank our teachers. There's 300 and or so teachers that have, on top of their regular duties of teaching, are also contributing to the curriculum rewrite. So we're looking at $64 million over a six-year period to completely rewrite the curriculum from K to 12. I personally have done all of the surveys. The last survey, for any parent, and I challenge anybody who's listening to this to please go on and do the survey. We need the feedback as much as possible, but the issue is that there's a lot of information there that's not necessarily directed to how our kids are going to learn. So, you know, some of the major things that we always hear about are numeracy, literacy, all of these things that our math scores have been suffering. So the focus, you know, needs to be on those core subjects, in my opinion. And if there are strategies that need to be used in order to teach children of various backgrounds, and we've got kids that are ESL, we've got special needs kids, we've got kids that may be suffering from anxiety, family issues, whatever, there's a gazillion different reasons that a child may not be learning to the best of their ability within a school situation. So we have these amazing things called teachers that use their professional responsibility to make sure that these children understand their core subjects. So the curriculum review, in as much as I've looked at this point in time, doesn't really give us a lot of direction as to what the government is actually doing. In fact, I challenge parents. I'd love to hear their feedback about what they feel about this. I have my own opinions. It took me 3 hours to do this one. Of course, I did all the subjects across all the lines and went over all the charts. I'm a little bit type A that way. But I would really appreciate the feedback, because the government is going to need feedback.
And what are parents telling you? Are they looking into it already? Are they filling out the forms? And are they confused or...
It's all of those things. So parents, one good thing that's happening here, I have to say, is I've never seen families so engaged in their children's education. And that's awesome, because that's how you keep your government accountable, whether that's me or somebody else, whoever is there. That's brilliant. It's beautiful. Parents are at the core of what happens at the education system. So their voice and their participation in this is super duper key. So one good thing that's happening here is that we're going to see a lot more parental engagement. I think that's wonderful. But in terms of, it's very confusing. Again, it's the same pattern. Consultation, clarity, reaching out to people, finding out what is it that is actually needed for these kids, and do, like, was it necessary to do a complete curriculum rewrite, or could we have evergreened? Could we have taken some of those subjects? We had all these issues with the math curriculum that had come out in the past. We haven't even enacted the School Act yet. Like, there's so many things that need to happen that the government is just not participating in. And it seems like there's all these sort of willy-nilly things that they're kind of throwing out as, you know, sort of tossing us a bone, as it were, to look as though something's actually happening with this within this curriculum. Well, then why don't we know the associations and groups that are impacting the teachers at the round tables at the level of where curriculum is being developed? Are they doing energy literacy? Is there any literacy about entrepreneurial behavior? Like, how are things going with these are kinds of things that impact us at the core level for our families here in this province. You know, like, what is it that they are changing so much? And the most concerning statement that I heard come up from the Minister of Education is that our kids are agents of change. So what does that mean?
Agents of their change?
God only knows, right? But the important piece being here is that...
They're being used?
The way I look at it is that our job as government is to create curriculum. We take that curriculum... And we create supports for that, so that the teachers, these magnificent human beings that basically raise our children for 8 hours a day in the school system, take this curriculum and they take the supports from that curriculum and they teach our children how to do these things. That is our responsibility. Our responsibility is to make sure that that's there. Whether or not a child is going to be an activist or not, or be a political person or whatever, hopefully those influences will come through critical thinking and the ability for a teacher to be able to bring all sides of an argument there, right? Like, that's the professional responsibility of a teacher. That's not a government's responsibility. A government's responsibility is to provide the curriculum. The teacher's responsibility is to teach the children.
Right. I totally agree. And I'm just getting nervous because of our just recent conversation. We talked about the unintended consequences of Bill 6, the unintended consequences of this year's Bill 1, and what are the unintended consequences of this massive curriculum change? It scares me.
Yeah, well, you know, the biggest thing that we can do, Ron, is make sure the government hears us. Our voice is so important here, and I can't stress that enough, and I talk to kids about that every chance I get within the school system, so that their voice, they understand their voice matters. It really does. I know it doesn't feel that way all the time, but it really does.
Enough of us, enough times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, Lila, many Albertans feel that parental rights with regard to their children's education are being eroded. Is that a legitimate concern?
I think that we choose choice in education. This is our decision. We choose to send our child to this school or that school, which is one of the things, like I've said 100 times, and I'll continue to say, which we support, especially in the Wild Rose Party, is choice in education. A parent has every availability to also get involved. And the best way for a parent to have that ability to participate is to actually be there. So make sure you're voting in your municipal elections for your trustees. Make sure you know who's at the table. Make sure that you're involved in your child's education. These are all things. And if for some reason, because of your work schedules or life or all those kinds of things that add up that may not allow you to participate as fully as some parents would, you know, talk to the other parents, talk to your children. I mean, we are our children's first teachers, right? So let's use that ability of our parenting and the love that we have for our children to engage the system, because ultimately, all of those people are accountable to the taxpayer, to the parents, to the, you know, these are, that's, that is the way it goes. So let's ask the questions. Let's participate. Let's get parents out and active. And there are a lot that are, sorry, I don't mean that to sound like they're not, but let's even further engage them.
Yeah. So there's the trustees locally, and mm-hmm. there's the local counselors, mm-hmm. and clearly our provincial MLAs
yes.
and cabinet and
yes.
and our whole party, provincial parties have a big influence on it. Everybody's involved. Families
yes.
are involved. Everybody. So choose wisely in all our elections.
Yes, and participate. Use your political muscle and use your vote.
And did we say buy Wild Rose as well as a PC member vote? Or that was before July the 8th, and then 22nd is the vote.
So. Yes, that's right.
Okay, sorry about that little plug for...
buying Wild Rose memberships. I'm all over buying Wild Rose memberships.
Yeah, and for using our muscle.
Yes, use your muscle.
It's the little muscle we have, right?
It is such a privilege to vote. Let's do it.
Yeah. So, Lila, some Albertans are feeling that education is going too far with regard to impressing the NDP views on social issues and religion onto Alberta's youth. Are you hearing that as well?
There's a combination of things. And again, I would actually go back to what I said earlier. Largely in part, that is because of the divisive nature of the government. Freedoms are very, very, it's an easy word to say and not always easy to uphold. And freedoms means standing up for what you believe in, but also the things that you may not believe in. And a government, a good government, is going to make sure that people are taken care of, that they're nurtured, that they feel that their voice matters. Whether that is in a public school is something that's more progressive, anything over to faith-based school. And that's why choice in education is imperative, because that's actually how we honor families the most, is by giving them those choices. So in situations where we're seeing that these, you know, alternative schools may not be a choice, and not because they didn't fund it, but because they're actively creating situations around parents not being able to put their children in those schools. That's where you get nervous, because that choice in education is the only way that we can make sure that we have that choice, that people are honored in their decisions on how to educate their children.
Awesome. I really, really appreciate that comment. Now, Lila, this goes back a little bit to our conversation already, but the Department of Education is going to do a financial review of the Calgary Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that just came up, and it related to Bill 1, I think, with the busing.
Yeah.
I think the CBE said, hey, we can't afford that. You'll have to give us more money, and now there's going to be
mm-hmm.
some help given in a financial review to the Calgary Board of Education. It's not happening in other places, but do you know anything about that? Is there any light you can shine on that? Or
the only I wish I could shine light. My goodness, that would be like the best day of my life if I could come up with a piece of clarity that could explain what goes on in this government's head. Let me put it this way. Bill 1 created chaos and carnage. This is a Band-Aid. This is a Band-Aid on a school board and a school authority that runs a $1 billion business. These folks, they have hundreds of thousands of students. And I support school authorities. Again, these are elected members of our society that are elected to make sure and take care and educate our children. Why would the minister do this instead of sitting down with CBE, behind whatever, sit down and hash this out and figure out, okay, what's happening? But instead, it's another politicization of a school authority that we entrust with, you know, hundreds of thousands of our children. Why not provide clarity? Why not look at it? Why are you blaming them, saying that they're not being transparent with their fund? How does that help out anybody? Now the parents are sitting there going, okay, well, what does this mean for us? And who's going to be impacted?
It feels like there's an ego involved here.
Maybe a little. I'm not sure. I just look at it and I just can't fathom for the life of me, just the common sense girl in me, why it would be that you would be fighting with the very authorities that uphold the curriculum that you are bringing forward. I mean, these are our local decision makers. They're the caretakers of our children for 8 hours a day. Like, let's have some common sense discussions. How about...
Great. I mean, you work so hard, and having a person like you being our Minister of Education would have been great. Lila, the Ministry of Status of Women, the responsibilities include leading women out of lower income situations or poverty, reducing barriers that keep women from leadership positions, and preventing violence against women and girls in all forms. How do you think the government is doing with respect to those responsibilities?
Well, one of the things that we've, well, personally, that we've been working really, really hard is forwarding ideas to end violence against women. The status of women for me actually presents a whole lot of opportunity here. And here's the way I look at it is that it's a collaborative ministry. It's a nonpartisan ministry in that in order to stop violence against women, like if that's what we're talking about right now, we have to educate our men. Right? And we have to make sure that that's a discussion. We shine light on those things. We don't hide from it. I always tell young women, actually young men and women, because I have two sons, as you know. So my job has been raising young men. And I'm always, I use the dinos saying is like, be fierce. And fierce isn't derogatory and it's not berating. It's strength and it's chutzpah. And it's a desire to shine a light on something that's not appropriate. So, and I know for myself, and I mean, Rachel Notley, I'll fight her every single day on policy, but it would take a bullet for her right to be there because I believe in that much in democracy. And the kinds of horrible things that are said about women in politics, and I mean, well, you've seen things about the men in our group as well, too. It's not like it's not happening to them, but the sexual violence against women and women in politics and women in power is overwhelming. So I think the best thing that we can do with a portfolio like the status of women is actually working collaboratively to make sure that we're elevating together, right? We're only as good as our partnership. We're only as good as our collaboration. We're only as good as the outreach that we do. So even today, I was at a school and I was saying to the young men and women sitting in the room, I said, well, look at the girl beside you. I said, someday you're going to need to defend her. Even if you don't like what she stands for. And I said to the young woman, I said, someday you're going to need to trust the young men that are sitting beside you that they'll defend you no matter what. And I said, it's your responsibility right now that you shine light on people who say hateful and derogatory comments around anybody. Nobody should ever, it has no place in politics, Ron. Mm-hmm. None. I will never align myself with anybody or people who use derogatory, debasing, and misogynistic, I guess for lack of a better word, commentary to try and tear somebody down. So if the status of women helps do that, it has to be through a sense of collaboration. It has to be through a sense of community.
Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about your son and your sons and helping them be fierce, I feel a little bit of that on social media, that we need to be more fierce with people who are so willing in their anonymity to degrade mm-hmm. other people, whether it's politicians or women or anyone else. But we can block them, we can do things, but it's just not acceptable. It needs to be a safer place to go.
I actually prefer to shine a light on it. If a keyboard cowboy wants to try and say something derogatory about me, well, let's show the world what you think.
Leave it there for a while.
Leave it there for a while and let it. I don't go down rabbit holes on social media. I use it to push out information. That's it. If you want to attack my policy, by all means, please. A good debate any day, I'm up for it. Let's do that. But if you are going to degrade me based on who I am, my gender, my sexual orientation, or any of those things, you have no place in having a commentary in politics or otherwise. Let's keep it respectful. Let's keep the egos out of it. Let's make sure we elevate the people that need to be elevated and that we do that in a partnership with people that have been successful, that know, that understand, and that people that care about what happens in this province.
Nice. Great points. And I noticed one of the points was about helping women out of poverty.
Right.
So helping lead them. I'm wondering, is there progress being made on that? And, you know, we see examples. Almost everyone has an example of maybe a single mother or something like that that's struggling. And mm-hmm. Are there things being done to help?
Well, I think there's single parents, for sure. There's definitely more probably single mothers than there are single fathers. But there's a lot of parents out there that are struggling. I think with respect to that, we've actually seen the government do some very good spending with respect to women's shelters and that kind of thing. I'm very happy to see that. It was definitely something that needed to happen. That's step one, right? With any person who is vulnerable, who has the inability to see through where they are, this way, good governance the responsibility of good governance is to make sure that we take care of our vulnerable people. We may have different ways of getting there, like if I'm looking at policy versus what's appropriate, we can talk about that on a lot of different levels. But as far as removing poverty, that actually means creating an environment where jobs and things can actually happen. That kind of policy is actually imperative to making sure people who are vulnerable have the opportunity to get a leg up, to start a job, to do any of those kinds of things. Well, as much as the government may be helping out with women's shelters and all these other things, they're creating policies that are actually throwing our families under the bus. So it's a really, really strange situation, because a government that seems to think that they know better about these social issues are the first ones that are going to throw the very people that they represent under the bus. And instead of allowing, I mean, there's so much philanthropy in this province. We're the highest per capita in the world in our philanthropy. And we want to help each other out. You know, all of the women's shelters and homeless shelters and Woods Homes and all these people, they have huge sponsorship from oil and gas, from local companies, from people who fundraise for them. Amazing Albertans who have stepped forward. Right? But if you create an environment where that's not possible because of bad policy,
right,
you're not helping out the people that you're intending to help.
So there's a number of different ways that we can help, as the goal is to help women out of poverty. There's a lot of not-for-profit organizations working on it. I was invited to by my friend Margot McAuliffe to an event from the Canadian Women's Association, where they have a program where their budget is about $3,000 to take a woman in poverty through the system and mm-hmm. give her the supports that she needs for whatever education it is to help guide her through. And they've had a tremendous success rate. And there's a group of women and men. We were invited, and we were able to help contribute. And it just warms me to see that much effort. Because you said, we help each other. Sometimes we don't need government. We do better than government just by saying this is important and we'll go do it. So,
well, and government can support those things, right? Because then they're sustainable. You'll actually help out more people down the line. So if you look at things like Catholic Family Services, Servants Anonymous, I could name off a whole bunch of other groups that do exactly the work that you're talking about. They inspire people to come forward and help and actually find jobs, find ways, find daycare, healthcare, whatever, education, whatever it is the need for that family at that moment in time. But the minute that we give them that hand up and we set them on that path, whatever mechanism that is, we have all sorts of things. But to suggest that government would know better is not appropriate. Government should be working through the people for the people that they represent, and using community to participate, using the people, the best resource are the people.
Nice. Okay, Leela, you're the founder and owner of Chestermere Community Health Center. It appears to be an Alberta Health Services operation
mm-hmm,
to me.
It is.
Can you tell what services are provided there and how you became the founder and owner?
So I'll just correct you. I'm the owner of the building. So I built the building, and this is actually in the past cycle when Bruce McAllister was the MLA here. So when we were doing that, we were working with the mayor before I ever had any, I never had plans to be elected, but when we were working on Bruce's campaign, we were also working really hard on bringing healthcare out here, because lab services and so many other things were necessary, because we do have an aging population as well too. So we wanted to make sure at least that start was there. So we actually own the land and built the building. So they pay rent to me, but I'm not the founder of that. I certainly pushed hard to make sure that we came out here. But any changes that happen with that AHS is... anything that happened beforehand is fine, but anything that changes after that would have to go through Ethics Commissioner, because it could be considered a conflict of interest because I work for the government, right? So right now we're good, but if we expand the facility or anything like that, there's certain things that have to go through the Ethics Commissioner to make sure that it's not in contravention to the contract that I hold as representing you in the legislature.
Sure, but what got you going on this? It was just the lack of services, or your family?
Yes.
What happened?
Lack of services. So my father-in-law went through a tremendously difficult cancer about 10 or 11 years ago. So, and we weren't living out here at the time, but my own father, who has severe diabetes, and when we get to that point where they can't drive, they're so dependent upon people. So we wanted to make sure in a city that was growing like this. And it wasn't specifically for them, but it's certainly what motivated my husband and I. And I literally have to give him more credit. He was the guts behind this thing. So he felt it was imperative for this community. And it's, again, about community building, right? Being able to have those lab services. And we're hoping to be able to expand those services at some time. But there's a lot of, you have to jump through a lot of hoops. There's a lot of things that have to be done in order for that to be available. So.
And you're a hoop jumper.
I'm seeming to be a very, a very busy athletic hoop jumper.
Yeah, well, I think for me, it's inspiring to be talking to you, to see all the things that you take on and all the things that you learn and impact, because you don't stop with just the knowledge. You move on to what can it be used for and how do we make it better. And it really is wonderful talking to you about all these issues today. And I know, because we're in a studio here, that you're an accomplished musician and a teacher and a recording artist. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about your musical background and what are you involved now still? Are you doing things with music?
Well, it's funny. I always say to people, you know, going into politics is a shock to anybody. For somebody like me, the worst part of my day once upon a time when I was a music teacher was that I had too much snot on my shirt from the little kids that hugged me around my stomach all the time. It was like the crunchy moment, right? But you would always walk out into the community with love, and people really loved seeing you because their children love you. And I learned so much from those families. And we were a very high performance studio, highly competitive. My son is a tenor, so he's hopefully going out to Ontario to to Waterloo to study at Wilfrid Laurier in their opera program. My other son is a brilliant musical little musical theater guy, and so music's always been in this house since the get-go. And I actually perform more now than I did before I was elected, because, well, for one thing, you can't pay me. So I'm a very, very good volunteer, and I really think that it brings a nice change of pace to have a politician, quote unquote, who had a job beforehand that can contribute positively in the way that music moves people. Right? Everybody can relate. We all love to sing or participate or listen to it in the car or whatever. You know, like, there's things that all of us can relate to. And I get to sing with my children, which is like the biggest blessing of my life. And as a result of this whole political movement, I've been able to bring my son into that. And he sings with me everywhere, all over the province. We've sung in Edmonton and Lethbridge and Hussar and Chesmere, you know. And so actually I'd have to say no, it's increased, it's probably quadrupled. I do miss teaching. I wouldn't lie about that. When I see the kids around the city and see them having moved on to my friends that are teaching, and I just, it's kind of bittersweet, because I'm so proud of them. They're beautiful, they're amazing. I saw them in concert this weekend. It just made my heart happy. But the bittersweet part was I wasn't on stage with them. Yeah. Performing and having contributed at this point to their musical life.
Yeah, you carried on with all that growth. Anyway, I had a similar experience when I retired. Our son coached me. I just wanted to play a song with him. I just wanted to play the guitar while he sang. He's a brilliant musician, he is. And anyway, I quickly went on to write a few songs, and we recorded them, Leela. We recorded them in a real professional studio. We hired musicians. My favorite day was vocal day, because it's kind of the old harmonies, 70s kind of harmonies sort of sounding music. And it's just creative on the moment. You get a new harmony line in your head and you sing it and together. So anyway, music is something for our souls. It's something to share. And I saw at one of the dinners I attended that you stood up and sang the national anthem. And you take music with you wherever you can and share it. And it's a very human and vulnerable thing, I think. And it just connects us, doesn't it?
It really does. I'm always honored when somebody will allow me to participate that way, because it really is good for my soul. It's very grounding. It's a very humbling moment. And if anybody wants to listen to me, I just feel completely grateful.
Yeah, and I want to add, because maybe our 32-year-old son who lives in San Francisco may listen to this one day. I don't know. But it was recording with him was one of the most important and impactful things in my life.
Aren't you glad that you had that opportunity? I'm so happy for you.
Tremendous. So, Leela, it's time for an Alberta Rose presentation. So this is your chance to give an Alberta Rose to a person or group who may have done something good for Alberta. Do you have anyone you'd like to give a rose to?
Yes, my first rose would actually go to the parents and the teachers of this province. I think that they have been thrown into a state of chaos, and I am so proud of the people that I meet that work together to make sure that our children get the best education that they can. I'm so proud of every single parent that I meet and all of the teachers that do such a beautiful job to educate our children. I'm just, that's my first rose. My second rose goes to Cody Johnson. And Cody Johnson stood up against horrible, horrible emails and terrible disparaging comments this weekend. And he stood up for all of us. And I'm so proud of him. I'm so proud he's part of our staff. I'm so proud of the strength that he showed. And I'm so proud of those of us that are in this wild rose that are inclusive and love people. And we stand up for all people in this province. And so my second rose goes to Cody.
All right. So if you're a parent and you're listening to this podcast right now, if you're a teacher or if you're Cody Johnson, picture an Alberta rose on your lapel presented to you right now by Leela Ahir. Very nice. All right, but now I get the job, and it's a different kind of job, Leela. I give out a penalty.
Okay.
It's the hard guy. I'm the hard ass here. So penalty I'm going to give, it's going to be to a person or group who has done something wrong for Alberta. And I will assess a minor, major, or match penalty,
okay,
just like in hockey. Mm-hmm. And Leela, I am assessing a match penalty to the federal government for their lack of action with regard to foreign financial involvement in the 2015 federal election. The Tides Foundation and the Lead Now Group spent $1.5 million U.S. in selected federal ridings with the purpose of defeating the Stephen Harper and the PC Party government. They boast now that they were 96% successful with their objective, and I would have be giving this penalty if it was for a different party or for a different person too. So the Canadians need to elect our own governments free of wealthy international interest groups. So here it is, a match penalty to the feds for their lack of action and delay in dealing with this very important issue. This needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. So Leela, with that said, I'm moving on, and we can talk about a political quote. So let me start, because I have one that you won't know anything about, and maybe you have one too, I don't know. But I want to talk about a person who I worked with many years ago. We were talking about Alberta education, and that's why I'm bringing it forward, and this came out of his mouth. I knew that the education system was in trouble when they started measuring the school year in minutes. So I don't know, some of us from time to time think that, you know, you hear about the negotiations and the issues that get discussed and the pettiness it seems to be of it, and we just want the kids to be educated, mm-hmm, and treated well, and our teachers to be able to teach and do the things that they want to do, and then there's union stuff, and we just hear bits of it and we get frustrated. Yes. And anyway, I thought it was a bit of wisdom in a few words, and I give kudos to my friend Jerry Pekush, who lived and worked at McLeod Enterprises for Edmonton.
And kudos to the teachers, the amazing teachers that have to work within this bureaucracy of, you know, that's going on. Bless their hearts.
They got to put up with, yeah, all that stuff. You're right. So do you have any quotes? Or?
I do. And if I could give out another red rose, it would be to Brian Jean too, because Brian Jean is the one I'm going to quote, and it's with respect to unity. And he has said on several occasions, let's get the ego out and let's do what's best for Albertans.
Well, Brian, on your lapel, if you're listening, is a rose from Leela Ahir. And so, Leela, we have an opportunity here to do an Alberta history moment. I don't know, would you like to
read one for? Thank you so much. The first schools in what is now Alberta were parochial. That is, they were organized, owned and operated by the church clergy, missionaries or authorities, both Roman, Catholic and Protestant. A nominal fee was often charged for the attendance of students at these schools, and the fee was more often waived as an act of charity or as an act of proselytizing or as an act of local solidarity. The first free school, which would now be called a public school in what is now Alberta, was established in the hamlet of Edmonton in what was then Northwest Territories in the early 1881. The school was established before the Northwest Territories had a territorial assembly and before there was any law for the territory respecting schools or local government or local taxation. The people of the hamlet of Edmonton elected trustees to govern the establishment and the operation of the school and submitted to an informal local taxation entirely on the basis of local solidarity.
Wow. I wonder how many teachers would like to be working in that environment.
Would certainly bring local decision making to the forefront, wouldn't it?
So there was a word in there, proselytizing. I had to look it up. I thought I might know, but I looked it up, and it actually means that they had to. What they were doing was luring kids and their away from the other religion by giving them free education. If you come over to be a Catholic, you get free education. And the same with the Protestant or the public school say, well, if you come over here, we'll give it to you free. So there's a little bit of financial competition going on at the time.
Oh, it's very interesting. But, you know, it probably was the beginning of the school choice, parental choice in education. So if that's where it started, then, you know, let's allow these folks and these families to choose their education for their kids.
Are there any other historical things that come to your mind that you'd like to...
Well, I was actually at one of the ATA meetings recently and met with the new heads of the ASBA. Wonderful women. And one of them had mentioned that along with being 100 years of suffrage, well, technically we're 101 years now, when women got the vote, was also when the ATA became an association. So it is enjoying its first 100 years of being an association as well, too. So I thought that was really interesting.
Wow, fantastic. So I love these history moments, Leela. It's inspiring to think of how people lived in the past and how they handled similar challenges to what we face today. It seems to be the same stuff, maybe bigger, a bit different, but it's all about getting kids educated and getting them into ability to have a good life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that hard, really. We make it hard sometimes. So Leela, we're gonna be signing off now. This has been incredible for me, but before we do, is there anything that I haven't asked you, anything you wanna add that we haven't talked about?
Just that I want to reinforce the importance of voting. I want to reinforce what a privilege it is to vote, that we have the ability within the next 3 years here to make some significant changes with our right to vote. And if I can encourage and inspire people to please come out and flex that political muscle and just come out and use your vote at this epic time to dissuade the egos and to get rid of the rhetoric and actually bring together a really great opportunity for a government that is transparent and accountable to its people. And also with the municipal elections coming up in October of 2017, you know, let's get out there, let's bring forward public service, let's, you know, bring the candidates out, go out and vote. I mean, Chestermere had a 26% showing in the last municipal election, and that was high. In 2010, it was only, I think it was 19%. In a situation like ours, 20,000 people, that's only 3,500 people determining the future of our city. So let's use our democratic rights. And if I can inspire you or anybody else to do that, then I feel like I've done my job properly.
Well, Leela, thank you so much. You've done so many other jobs. You have inspired me to do that. I will be voting. I'll get both memberships in voting. But there's so many other things that you have a large depth of knowledge. You study hard when you're at school and you work hard. I know that you're conveying this message to many people and you're working with your colleagues to help make change, to help this province get around. And I hope that you're part of the next government when we do form one.
Thank
so to you, thank you so, so much for giving your time today. And it's a wonderful way for people to get to know you. This is tremendous.
And thank you for the opportunity. I'm so grateful to be able to speak to you. And thank you for all that you do for getting our messages out there. It's tremendously gratifying. Thank you.
Thanks again, Leela. And thank you to all of our listeners. Again, you can read my blogs and listen to all of our podcasts on sensiblealberta.ca. You can download podcasts to your phone and listen to them anytime, anywhere you want. And to all of you, thank you so much again, and we hope that you will join us next time.
Okay, let's go.